that has a Q of over a million. When you try to build that out of real materials, and you've got a problem. There was a fascinating article that was published in the Microwave Reflector about a year ago of a guy who did an exhaustive study of 432 dipoles. He was making dipoles out of 16th inch, 3/32, 8th inch, 3/16th inch, and whatever. He was doing it in Finland, so therefore he was using millimeter equivalents of wires. But he was building dipoles out of these wires, and of course the dipole itself would radiate. He wanted to know the real loss coefficient of the dipole. So he built a great big shielded box with very tight corners on all six sides, with finger stock on one side so he could open up the corner, he could open up one side of the box. He would plug his dipole in the box, suspend it on thread in the middle of this shielded enclosure, close the door, and then by way of probes, he would excite signals into the dipole and measure the real bandwidth of the dipole and interpret that into Q, and therefore calculate the loss characteristics of the dipole. And he was making the dipoles out of aluminum wire, copper clad, various diameters, and whatever. And so when it comes to 2, 3, and 5 element Yagis built out of these wires, the loss numbers were so low as to not be significant. The main reason he was doing this research is he knows that a number of very serious people are making Yagis on 432 that have 22, 33, 44 elements to them. Real, real long. And so when you get to these structures where you're starting to light up a whole lot of parasitic elements, he was concerned that the cumulative effect of the resistive loss characteristics of the dipoles will start piling up. Well, my experiments with superwide elements lead me to believe there's a tremendous amount of benefit to be had out of wide elements. There are naive people who used to think that a wide element would be low in Q, broadband resonance, in other words, would mean that it would not give you the proper Yagi effect when used as a dipole. From my point of view, I've disproved that. So I see great merit in building Yagi-like elements as long as you want, as far as the boom length is concerned, put in a zillion elements if you think you can do a good job at tuning them, and making large in diameter so that the efficiency goes up. I think you can put it all together, and I don't think you've seen nothing yet. Now, if you combine everything you're hearing and talking about here, if we now start building the elements of the driven element of the Yagi and the parasitic element, that's another whole series of questions. But when it comes to dipoles and loops, you haven't heard the end of the story. Guarantee when it comes to Yagis, end fire effects, parasitic antennas, we haven't heard the end of the story. Let me give a couple of words over to Mel. May have a few words to add to this, and then pass it right back to you, Fred. K2KUY, K2IW in the TechNet.
Oh, yeah, this is K2KUY. Years ago, when I first started with the computer programming and modeling, they came up with a program called MiniNEC, M-I-N-I-N-E-C. And I spoke to, he had a disclaimer. The guy who wrote the program. And if you want to discuss it, he says, give me a call. But, of course, he put on it, it's your nickel. So, in other words, you call me. I will not call you back type of thing. So I, okay, so that's my nickel. And I called him, and I had a discussion with him. And he says, really, he says, any of the computer modeling, remember, he says, you're assigning, we're using wires. In other words, you're technically using X, Y wires that you're assigning in space, as you said, in three-dimensional space, is basically somewhat more of a, like I use the Smith chart. It gives me a ball, gets me into the ballpark. But for finite, for the finite final design or whatever, you did it the right way. You've got to go back to the hands-on with the electric drill out and the files and the hacksaw, and they'll do it that way. Because this is basically why QST and Number Magazine have given up really giving any kind of really, you know, information as to gain and other factors about antennas. In other words, they don't review antennas anymore because in most cases the manufacturers of the antennas are exaggerate a little bit, as putting it mildly. But basically, that's what it says, that these computer modeling programs get you into the ballpark, and now it's up to you to see what the heck is really going on. And in fact, that's what I'm going to discuss with you. I did an experiment this last week and a half or so, and I'll tell you what happened with another loop, like a loop, a receiving loop. And I want to get your opinion if you can give me some input on this. So this is what the situation is with any of these computer modeling. They're great. They do a lot, but as they say, you got to also, you know, understand where they're coming from and what, you know, what is possible in real world, Dick, over.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head here, Mel. Anybody who has done any serious work with real hardware and done computer modeling, almost always they talk about the PCO effect. In other words, post-computer optimization. The computer can help you a lot, but the guy who wrote the computer program almost always had to do some form of simplification in order to make a program in a reasonable number of lines and a reasonable number of man-hours. They never get down to the molecular level of modeling. So therefore, the computer program does have a certain percentage of error. You read any of the articles of any of the guys who've done computer modeling of ham radio antennas, you will frequently hear the guy say, gee, the computer predicted I would have a zillion dB of gain and almost a zillion dB of front-to-back ratio, and I followed the computer program exactly, and the antenna turned out to be 433.1 megacycles when I wanted it to be on 432, and then I went out there and trimmed it. So I've heard that story over and over again. So there's almost always post-computer optimization. For the work that I was doing the PCO first. And for my particular method of doing it, where I had a compact antenna range that was very handy for me to use, and a well-calibrated Rodin-Schwartz dual-channel network analyzer. In fact, it could display as many as four channels at once. I could have a grand old time and do literally 1,000 experiments per day. You would have loved using that piece of instrumentation, Mel, and I still use it almost every day. Fred and Mel. K1FC, K2LIW and the TechNet.
Yeah, well, having used the when I've had chance to play around, and as you know, I even wrote my own program. Kind of curious. I sent you an email, but I didn't know whether the address was a good email address or not. I updated my feedline analysis program as a result of the discussion with the smell chart, and I realized that I could make a minor change that would make it a lot more compatible if you were trying to do something, compare it with doing something with a Smith chart. And I have come up with some other antennas, or an antenna concept. Of course, it's not a Yagi, so I don't know, maybe you wouldn't be interested in it. It's not something terribly profound, but it's what I call my emergency dipole design using speaker wire. I discovered experimentally and then later confirmed on the internet that if you want to make a, the antenna book talks about zip cord dipole from zip cord for feed line. And zip cord is about the lossiest signal material you could ever find. But clear speaker wire, which while not great, is much, much less lossy than zip cord. And you can build a multi-band antenna using it and using the a section of it for your matching. Over to Mel, K1FC.
Fred. Well, this is K2KEY. Oh, yeah, I agree with you 100%. When you start, unfortunately, with many hands, and this is one of my beef I have with with the number of the magazine. The vast majority of amateur radio operators right now in this country are operating from urban areas where if you are lucky enough to put up an antenna or even able to get an antenna somewhere up there, it's got to be very unobtrusive in most cases. Very few of us are fortunate enough to be able to pick an 85-foot tower in the backyard like I have here, a fixed steel tower, like Dick has a 100-foot tower or whatever. You know, there isn't that many people that have these privileges now because of all the restrictions. And, of course, in Brooklyn here, where every new building that goes up here is a, you know, it's a multi-story building, and there's no way that you're going to have access even to the roof, even if you buy a condo. So the vast majority of them have to figure out some kind of compromise antennas. And the beef I was getting back to with magazines is they'll always show somebody on the front page that sits in front of a killer box, a bunch of fancy radios piled up one on top of the other, and I can see it's in a killer box. And in the background is a humongous tower that reaches into the stratosphere with a huge God knows what on top of it in the way of a beam, you know, stacked arrays and everything. This is a very small percentage of amateur radio operators that can use this kind of have the facilities and the, you know, the finances or whatever. So more and more have to use antennas that are, we call them clandestine, we call them CIA type antennas, you know, whatever you want to name them, hidden antennas, whatever. And in fact, I did some experimenting with a friend of mine. I built him a transmitting loop for use in a house in New York City. We made up this transmitting loop for 20 meters. And eventually, we made a copper pipe from Home Depot using elbows and everything, and he took it home, soldered it finally together, the final piece of equipment. He had to take it home in pieces, literally, get it on the train, and then sprayed it matte black, you know, so that it wouldn't show up shine or anything, you know, because it's strictly prohibited. So things like you just said, Fred, with speaker wire, things, there should be more published, this is what I'm getting back down to, more published for people that are going to use speaker wire. This cord are going to be people that are looking to put an antenna that, like I say, is mostly for people that have to hide the antenna or make it so that, you know, that they won't attract any attention. Do you agree with me? Over.
Yes, I do. Now, part of what I think is going on here, Mel, is that to sell a magazine, it's got to be exciting. There's a super antenna of some kind. We all dream about that. When you see that on the cover of a magazine, it tends to make you want to buy the magazine. Sensationalism does sell. Yes, it does give the wrong impression, and it turns off some people saying that, hey, this is a rich man's hobby. I can't compete. I'm not going to have any fun. I can't go there. However, you're right. They got to somehow convey that this is the dream station and that only 0.01% of the hams have it. If they showed month after month a typical ham shack like mine, which is kind of sloppy, a lot of stuff piled around, if they showed a picture of that, it would turn people off. Some people would be turned on, some people would be turned off. It's a difficult situation to have a happy medium. By the way, Mel, I recently have been using Google Earth or Google Maps or whatever it's called, and I had a lot of fun zeroing in on Paris, France, go over a couple of miles to the west of the center of Paris, France, find the Eiffel Tower, and look at that beautiful high-resolution picture of the Eiffel Tower top down. It makes such a beautiful picture, particularly if you've got a color printer. But I've made some prints of that and showed it to people. It's a real mind blower. By the same token, I can go to my particular house and I can see the shadow of my tower across the roof of my house. When I go to Dover Street in Brooklyn, I don't see the shadow of your tower across the roof of your house. Well, so I'm guessing that the sun was in the wrong position that day. Top down, our radio towers don't show. But the shadow that they cast on the ground does show. I've got two separate towers. One of them's against the house, and it casts a shadow across the gray roof of the house, a ranch-type house, and it's easy to see. My second tower is 70 feet away from the house in the woods, buried in some pretty high trees. And so the shadow on the ground of the trees dominates, and you don't see the shadow on the ground of the tower. So you can't see my second tower. I wonder if you've done anything like that, Fred. I wonder if you've looked for your particular QTH on that Google Map program. It's a real fun program. Fred, you did send me the right address. I did get the address of your computer program, but I have not opened it yet. Right now I'm in a great big fiasco that I've created with the Queensland VHFer. In Australia, the Queensland VHFer magazine, in the last 2 months, published two of my articles. One of them was on superimpedance matching of a dipole to get it down to a 1.005. And that article went through nice and smoothly. My second article is on the subject of ideal side lobe levels of antennas. When it comes to parabolic dish antennas and the ideal side lobe levels when you maximize the gain, I got no flack on that. But then I speculated you want similar side lobe levels on the proper tuning of a Yagi. And oh my goodness, am I getting a flat on that. Anybody who works in academia in Australia is now giving me rebuttals on that. In order to make the smoke clear on that one, I proposed a testing procedure by which they should be able to confirm or deny my hypothesis on that one. You probably know that Mr. C.E. Seebeck, W4AND or something like that, I can't remember his call letters, he's got at least 100 pages published on the subject of long Yagis with the side lobes 25 dB down. It is my strong belief that when you tune the side lobes 25 dB down on a Yagi, you have knocked down the side lobes, that's the good news, but you have sacrificed potential gain in the process. That's my belief. And it's going to take at least a year of computer modeling, testing, and whatever to confirm or deny my hypothesis on that one. When it comes to receiving loop stuff, Mel, or when it comes to any kind of receiving antenna, the directivity and efficiency of the antenna is the main thing that dominates. Well, I say efficiency. The directivity is what dominates in receiving on HF band. Efficiency does not matter. When you transmit, it matters very much. When you're receiving, it doesn't. Because an antenna looking at the horizon on 40 meters probably sees something like a 50 decibel noise figure. So until you get 40 dB of inefficiency, you would never see the inefficiency of an antenna in the receiving mode. In the transmitting mode, you'll certainly see it. If you had 50 dB of inefficiency and you're transmitting a kilowatt, the guy listening to you will think you're putting out 10 milliwatts, if you know what I mean. So there's a brand new set of rules that come into play when you're building a receiving antenna, and that's the strength of a beverage. That antenna can really, and its variance, can do magic. Let me turn it over to you, Fred, for some of the comments and all the above. K1FC, K2RIW on the TechNet.
W2PNJ.
PNJ recognized. Fred first. Go ahead, Fred.
Yeah, okay. Comments now. Yeah, the purpose of my speaker wire antenna was something that was actually intended for field day. Regrettably, when I first did it, I used the older version of EasyNet, which did not take into consideration the insulation on the wire. Later, I got the newer version, because when I tried it, I didn't get quite the results that I was told that the model set. Well, there were a couple of things in models. It's almost impossible to know exactly what your soil conditions are going to be and getting your height exactly right. And that's one of your biggest variables in the real world, along with a bunch of other things. And the insulation, if you model it without insulation, when it has it, it's about 2 to 3% off. But the concept was an interesting one in the off center fat. And this was before I knew about, had ever seen a Carolina with them. I was just, you know, how to try to accomplish something, and it turned out the impedance theoretical impedance of the zip cord of the speaker wire was in the range of what I needed, so that you had a section of speaker wire, and then you just use speaker wire for the rest of the antenna. You had something that you could roll up. Get a whole bunch of bands, but I couldn't get 80 meters at the same time as I could get all the other bands, so they got discouraged, but I could get 40 odd up pretty good. The other station, I think it was PMJ, I may have misremembered, but this is K1FC.
Yeah, W2PNJ, you got it, Bob. And what's the latest in Kings Park?
Good evening, guys. I just wondered if it was too late to ask a ham-related question.
Now, we're only discussing ham radio subjects here right now, Bob. Go right ahead.
Okay, thank you, Dick. Contemplating getting an amplifier. I'm running now like 100 watts. And I noticed in reading some paperwork on it that you have to shut off your built-in antenna tuner on your transceiver. What means do you have for tuning up that, you know, that slight mismatch? I'm losing something in the translation here, or it's not a factor anymore. Can you give me some enlightenment on that?
Well, I've got a couple of guesses as to what's going on there, Bob. First of all, when you've got an amplifier, quite often there's a, when you properly use the amplifier, there's an ALC circuit, in other words, to make sure you don't overdrive the amplifier so you don't splatter so that it's still linear. There's usually another BNC, RCA phono plug cable that goes from the amplifier back to your driver, and if the two are compatible with each other, it's cutting that drive. As such, you usually have more drive than you need in the exciter, and therefore exact impedance match is not required. So if your final amplifier had a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, which means you've got half a dB of loss due to VisWire, but you've already got 6 or 10 dB more drive than you need, there's no need to do the tuning. Second of all, because the amplifier is an active device, not a passive device, it could easily confool an automatic antenna tuner. The automatic antenna tuner sends out a known amount of signal, looks at the amplitude and phase angle of what reflects off your antenna, and it retunes itself accordingly. But because you're going into an active amplifier, what it gives back could have a crazy relationship. It could have a crazy relationship. It doesn't move correctly as a function of drive level. And there's the real problem. In the case of an antenna, if your antenna has a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, it will be a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio whether you drive the antenna at 1 watt, 10 watt, 100 watt, or a kilowatt. As long as the antenna is not arcing over, it's always a 2-to-1. When you're driving either a solid-state amplifier or a tube amplifier, as you change the drive power, you change the amount of grid rectification that's taking place, and therefore its impedance changes. So that changing characteristic could drive an automatic antenna tuner crazy, and it may go grinding and grinding and never come up with a solution. So if you just took the mid position for a 50-ohm load of the antenna tuner, hopefully it starts off there when it's turned off, then you have less grief when you go into an amplifier. These are some of my guesses as to what I think is going on there, Bob. W2PNJ, K2IW in the TechNet.
Okay, thank you. I got two more questions. I hope they're not bogging you down on the first time. I know it's late. I apologize for coming in late. With regard to the amplifier, what do I gain in far as S units or as far as going from like 100 watts to 600 watts, for example?
Just happen to have a calculator in front of me, and I can give you an exact answer. A 6-to-1 power ratio just happens to be 7.8 dB. Since one S unit on a well-calibrated S meter is 6 dB, you'll have 1.2 S units or something like that. Let me divide that by 6 just to be exact. 6 divide. 1.3 S units of increase when you use the amplifier on a well-calibrated S meter. Since almost everybody's S meter is the opposite of Scotch, they're very liberal. Some S meters in some portion of the S meter range will have only 3 or 4 dB per S unit instead of 6. So when you turn on that amplifier, some of the guys you talk to are going to see two full S units on their particular receiver of increase. 100 watts to 600 watts, particularly if you're involved in a DX pileup, you're about to ask us, is it worth it? Yay, verily. At 600 watts, a certain percentage of the time is going to allow you to get through. You'll climb above the rabble, so to speak, unless you've got a super antenna in the backyard. You've got two ways of making yourself loud to that DX station that everyone's shouting to. You're either going to use an acre of an antenna, or you're going to use a really potent afterburner. Now back to you, Bob.
You must have seen the footprints on my head from being stepped on. Okay. You answered my question. One last thing. I've been hearing by one of the fellows in the club about a hex beam antenna. Do you know anything about that, Dick?
I've heard the name, and I don't know what it is yet. Although I think someone did mail me an article on that one. If I remember correctly, it looks like an upside-down umbrella built into sort of a almost a cubicle quad-like thing laying flat. So I think I have seen it, and it does look like a fairly attractive antenna. In other words, a way of getting an awful lot of wire in the air with just one main center support post, if I remember correctly. So quite possibly Mel knows about that. Let's pass it over to him. K2KEY. K2I doesn't detect that.
Yeah, Roger, this is K2KEY. Yeah. The XC, well, they had a number of names for it. I got that. Years ago, oh boy, I remember they had one for 10 meters years ago, and it was it was a fascinating antenna, Vic, and geez, for the life of me, I can't recall what they were turned. Bowtie, I think they called it bowtie antenna, I think that's what he's referring to, over.
He did say hex beam. Hotel X-ray, Hotel Echo X-ray is the way I think Bob pronounced it, X-beam. And the thing that I've seen reminded me of the way you would build a stressed parabolic dish antenna. You have a bunch of spokes, and you have perimeter wires wrapped through those spokes in kind of circles. And so I think it's a little bit like a multiple loop antenna. Let me pass it over real quick to Fred, if he remembers what a X-beam is. K1FC, K2IW, and detect that.
Yeah, they look exactly like you were describing. It's sort of like three poles, but that's this, looks sort of like a spider web type thing. As soon as you mentioned it, I did it first, and I have a picture in front of me as to what it looks like. Final question, because I have to retire. I did look at my house on Google Earth. I have. Unfortunately, most of Connecticut is not high res. My house is in high res, but the photo is old, and you can't see very much. They had a whole lot of trees taken down after the photo was taken, waiting for them to update it. I'm going to say 73, and maybe I'll be able to check in next week. Back to you, Dick. K1FC, Chris.
Very fine, Fred. Have a happy new year tonight. So, Bob, a buddy of mine owns that thing called a hex beam. He's a buddy who lives in Alabama. who for a whole lot of years lived on Long Island. He's been using it for a couple of years. It survived one of the hurricanes they went through, so he thinks it's pretty rugged. And he's been using it over and over again. He's an antenna man from way back. The fact that he's happy with it suggests that it can't be a terrible antenna. I think it could be pretty good. W2PNJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, thank you so much. Yeah, this antenna is made by Traffy Technology up on in Ashby, Maine. And it's only got like a 9 foot or so turning radius. They make a multiband. They call it an HX5BI. It goes 20, 17, 16, 12, and 10. 9.4 turning radius. And it's only about 20 pounds in weight. They recommend it up about 40 feet for maximum efficiency on it. It's got, gain on all bands. I think it says about 4.5 dB. And it's got a nice front-to-back ratio on all these bands, too.
Out of curiosity, Bob, roughly how many dollars is that product?
Come back with that?
What's the price of that? Roughly how many dollars?
Hold on. I got the sheet in front of me. Just hold on a second. $10.
Okay, Barry recognized. Bob, once again, how many dollars?
Approximately $900-$950.
Okay. A little bit on the pricey side, but does cover a lot of bands. Barry, N2 Moonbound, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, I'm going to wait until you guys beat this to death. And then I just wanted you to know I was here because I have a question on antennas. And I think you're the man, N2MB.
Okay. Wonder if you were listening earlier. We were waxing elegant about making huge improvements of the good old-fashioned loop antenna and the dipole antenna. So getting back to my final questions with you, Mel, when it comes to a receiving antenna, forward front-to-back ratio, front-to-side ratio is all important. The beverage antenna, for instance, you put that 600 ohm load resistor in there, and the average ham is horrified by the fact that one-third or one-half of his valuable RF power is going to go into that load resistor. And he says to himself, why the hell do I want to do that? Well, that load resistor is what gives you the right front-to-back ratio. And that's one of the reasons you build a beverage. If you let that beverage aim toward Europe, and that guy behind you in California is on the exact same frequency, and if you can get a 20 dB front-to-back ratio and knock that California QRM down by 20 dB, that's definitely worth it. And so efficiency on reception doesn't matter, and pattern does. So the designs of purely receiving antennas can be very, very different than transmitting antennas. And you can make up the difference with transmitting if you want to use a whole lot of watts or go to a different kind of an antenna. The front-to-back ratio, in general, except for the fact you may be QRMing that guy in California, the front-to-back ratio doesn't matter. So if you had a super good front-to-back ratio with your beverage, talking to your buddy in England, and not being QRMed when you're receiving from the guy in California, and then you had a super high efficiency antenna with a lousy front-to-back ratio, but it's aimed at your buddy in England, you could be transmitting on that antenna and receiving on the other. And except for the fact the guy in California may get mad at you, that could be a very good mix there. But on my other subject there, Mel, when I go to Dover Street, I don't see the echo, I don't see the shadow on your roof or on the ground of your tower. So your tower must be a fairly skinny structure that doesn't cast much of a shadow. K2KEY, K2IW in the TechNet.
Hey, this is K2KEY. I'll make some comments first. First, good evening to Barry, and then I'll tell you about our experience with Barry. I'll have 75-meter experience with Barry, myself, and my friend George in Pennsylvania the other day. And first of all, oh, it's hex beam. I thought he kept saying hex beam. X-ray is hex with an H. Henry, hex beam. Yeah, I know about the hex beam. That's not new. It's been around quite a while, and it's been remodeled somewhat, and I heard a few of them around. I don't know whether or not they live up to their reputation or whatever, but now I know what Chantenne is talking about. As far as Google goes, yeah, you gotta look at this the right way. First of all, the tower is all painted nice, beautiful. You know, aluminum paint now, it shines like a mirror. Because I did it all over in June with new guy wires. Everything's nice and shiny now. And if you look, I looked at it. I have to look just right, I guess, when the sun, let me see, where was the sun at the time when I saw it? Ah, the sun was in the west. When the sun is in the west the right way, I could see the back tower, the 85-foot tower, casting a shadow. The front one, the other tower, you got to look, there's a tree. It's like in between the tree and the house. That's the 45-foot tower. So that shows up, too, I think, a little better. But I was able to see both of them at times. Now, as far as the Smith chart goes, I want to make a comment about that because there was a number of emails. One of the emails thanked us very much for the Smith chart privilege, which he said that he was the only one in the class that got an answer to a matching or some problem, antenna problem, correct. And he wants to know, first of all, is there any type of manual or some kind of tutelage that is in print that is readily available showing all kinds of applications of the Smith chart? So I said, I will ask Dick, do you know of anything that goes through the Smith chart, all different procedures and whatnot, in a concisive manual and explains it step by step? Is there anything like that in print? Over.
Yes, definitely. Lots of stuff are printed on the Smith chart. Lots of books. Poser, P-O-Z-A-R, is a very expensive microwave textbook that does have a chapter on the Smith chart. The Introduction to Electronics by Krauss. Krauss's book on electronics has a section on the Smith chart. I didn't say either one of them are nicely written. They're written for a college junior or college senior level class. If you go to the, if you go to Google and just use as a search word Smith chart or Smith chart explanation, Smith chart instruction, guarantee you'll get 1,000 hits. And when you plow through them, you'll find some very good ones. I'd like to believe there's a nice section of the ARL antenna book on the chart. I don't think so. I'm not convinced that they covered it very well. There was a beautiful article on the subject written as an internal memo in the company I used to work for. And that particular man passed away. I don't have a copy of that, unfortunately. So the best I would go to is a Google search on Smith chart and Smith chart instruction, Smith chart theory, words like that. If you go to Amazon, I know there are books on the subject. And in fact, Mr. Smith himself must have written a book on the subject. Hewlett-Packard application notes has quite a bit of information. I don't know which one. The reason why Hewlett-Packard application notes would have it is because many of their early network analyzers displayed the data as a Smith chart on the cathode ray tube of the network analyzer. And therefore, when you plow through the instructions on how to use the network analyzer, left-handedly, you are getting Smith chart instruction. So my two best search methods would be Google and Amazon. That's about the best I can recommend. There is a chapter in Theodore Marino, Microwave Transmission Circuits, but that's an old paperback book, a little bit hard to buy. And he goes through both the Smith chart and the early predecessor to it, the rectangular chart, the Cartesian chart, that eventually became the circular Smith chart. He's got a medium good section. The Theodore Marino book has got so many other very valuable pieces of information. I bought that as a used paperback book. I think I paid $15 for it. And if I found it today, if I didn't have it, and I found it today as a used book for $50, I would buy it. In my opinion, that book is that valuable, even though it's a 1950 book, or 1948. Theodore Marino used to work for Sperry Gyroscope. Genius of a guy. I don't think he's around with us anymore. I don't think he's a ham radio operator. So these are some of my best suggestions on Smith Chart information film. Let's see what Barry's got. We've got some new exotic antenna. That's 22 dB of gain, and only occupies 1 cubic foot. So let's hear about it. And by the way, I've got to look up your house in Far Rockaway and see if I can see your tower as a shadow on the ground. Here we go. Barry. N2 Moonbound, KGYIW on the Tech Map.
Dick, don't forget W2DU, KCJJ.
In other words, W2DU, I think you're saying his book, yes, Reflections on Reflections. I think you're saying he has quite a bit of Smith Chart theory. Is that what you're saying, Fred?
Yes, indeed, Dick, K2JJ.
And that W2DU book is an ARRL publication. I think it's entitled Reflections on Reflections, or More Information on Reflections. You go to the ARRL website and do a search on W2 Delta Uniform, and you'll find some other pretty nice books. N2 Moonbound, K2IW.
Okay, K2IW and N2MB. Actually, you're right. I do have this crazy antenna design that fits in a shoebox and gives you oopteen gain. There is something that I've been looking at. I know that you've seen it. I brought this up to Mel the other day. It's a four-square antenna. It's becoming somewhat popular. There is, however, a different design of the four-square, which I ran into by accident. And I wanted your opinion on it. The first thing I'll try to do is explain it. Most four-square antennas are four verticals. They're spaced about, from one to the other, about 90 feet across from one to the other. And they have a million radios underneath each one, and they got this fancy, phasing box, that puts it ahead or behind, phasing thing. And they also have something which I'd like you to explain to me. They have something called the one port. You put a dummy load on it or something. I'm not sure why that is. It has something to do with the phasing. I saw another design for the four square, which I thought was very unique. This guy has about a 100-foot tower, which puts me in his category, and he has four wires coming off the top of the tower. They look like arrows pointing away from the tower. So they're inverted Vs on their side. They're actually full-size dipoles. They're not verticals. They're vertically polarized, but they're dipoles. Center-fed. They're like inverted Vs on their side. And they're pointing away from the tower like four arrows. So what you've got is the top and the bottom of each of these verticals are almost touching each other because they come back to the tower. Now, I wanted your opinion if that would actually work, if that would be a gain antenna. I mean, he's got the spacing, he's got the phasing, but he plays this trick. And the idea why I like that so much is because I can do this on a single tower and on my own property. And we'll start there, K2IW and 2MB.
Yeah, I remember doing a search 6 months ago on the subject of four square, and there's a couple of guys out west who have got a zillion acres of property who have set up a whole lot of these four square and six square and whatever type antennas, and are claiming some very good performance. All of these antennas, in my opinion, fall under the category of a phased array, and you're about to ask, what is the general definition of a phased array? If I've got multiple efficient antennas, such as a ground plane antenna with a good set of ground plane radials, so I'm not lighting up the earth, and all the watts that I put into the antenna, the monopole or ground plane, most of those watts are being radiated somewhere into space, Once you've got that characteristic for a basic element of the array, and you put up multiple elements, you now can really do magic. If I've got on my property four separate monopoles, where each one is a fairly efficient antenna, and if I got the ability to adjust the power and or phase of the signal that I send to those four monopoles, I can steer that antenna probably in eight distinct directions in space, and depending on the spacing of those, let me think of, if you've got the right spacing and the right feeding, in theory, four monopoles can give you 6 decibels, and maybe a skosh more, 6 decibels of gain in the selected direction. So that's that quadruples your power in the selected direction, and you've got electronic steering of the direction. And if you go one step further, you can have electronic nulling in the undesired direction. In other words, if you're talking to your buddy in England, to the northeast from your location, and you're getting some strong QRM from the north or the northwest with a phased array and proper electronic steering of it, you could steer a very deep notch in the northwest direction and essentially eliminate that QR Mary you're getting from that guy. And that kind of an antenna can have equal efficiency on transmit and receive and have all of these goodies. So, multiple elements displaced in space, properly fed as a phased array, because they're not smart in the way you adjust amplitude and phases of the signal to them. You have electronic steering. You can steer that beam in microseconds. In some cases, you can make multiple main beams at the same time that you're making one or more notches in the undesired direction for the interfering signal. Now, with a single tower supporting multiple inverted Vs or V-like antennas, traveling wave V antenna, traveling wave Yagi, I think was the thing that, I can't think of the name of the company that in the late 50s was manufacturing a television aerial that looked like a Yagi, except each one of the elements along the boom of this television aerial was a set of Vs. Started with a C. It wasn't Cushcraft. Can't think of the name of the company now. Maybe you can remember it. An old antenna television aerial company. So, in your case, you're building multiple of these Vs in at least four different compass directions. Again, you can feed them as a phased array. The only basic requirement for a high-efficiency phased array antenna is that the individual elements of the array should be efficient and should have different phase centers. If by some magic you were foolish enough to take your four square and move those four monopoles closer and closer together, your benefit would go to zero. So you must have some fraction of a wavelength of displacement between the phase centers of the individual elements. Once you've got that, and even if the individual elements are omnidirectional, still by feeding them as a phased array, you can end up with a directional antenna. If your basic elements are displaced in space and simultaneously directive, now you can get a double benefit. You can get the benefit of the directivity of the individual elements added to the directivity of the phased array. That's what you and I did when we put up 16 Yagis. Each Yagi had 15.5 dB of gain. We had 16 of them. They gave us another 12 dB. Therefore, we had 27.5 dB of overall gain capability as a 16 Yagi array thing. And if we went the next step and were able to phase shift the signals that we sent to the 16 Yagi, we could have electronically steered that in azimuth elevation space in microsecond periods and had a grand old time with that thing. M2 Moon Bounce, KQIW on the Tech Man.
Channel Master.
That's the name I was thinking of, Channel Master. You got it, Barry.
Okay, so this this is the number of things that come into play here. First of all, as I explained to you, the elements are about 90 feet apart, you know, when you draw a line from one to the other. There are about 60-something, if you make a square out of them, you know, go 60, 60, 60, or 65, something like that, you know. But all the way across, it's about 90-something feet. So the spacing between, let's say, a driven and a reflector or something like that would be about 90 feet. The side antennas, you know, I think you can picture that. They're in a square around the tower, and the center, the feed point, is about, what is it, out from the tower, it's about 55 feet or something, like 45 feet, about 45 feet out from the center of the tower. And, of course, the top and the bottom are V'd back. Now, the fact that the top and the bottom are V'd back and they almost touch each other, how detrimental is this going to be? I mean, if you made a two-element Yagi, let's say it was parasitic, not driven, and you bent the elements back until they almost touched each other at the end, would that destroy it? I mean, you know, would it work? So how critical is that? Also, the fact that these are driven, and every element is driven, that means that its place in space is pretty much, you know, its phase is pretty much determined by the coaxial cable it's going to, the length of the cable. You know, you're putting it ahead or behind in phase by lengthening or shortening the cable to the particular antenna. He does all this in a big switching box that you can buy. Now, that brings my next question up. If it's all done in the switching box, all the cable is in the box, then does it matter what length of cable is going out to the individual dipoles, or can they all be, whatever they are, as long as they're all the same length, would that be okay? Or do they have to be a quarter of a wave or a half wave? Would it make any difference? Because all of that is actually being taken place in that little switching box in the middle of the tower out there, so to speak. Also, another question is, because these are vertical dipoles, inverted Vs, but they're vertical dipoles, and the bottom element of the dipole is so much closer to the ground than the top one. Remember, this thing is like 120 feet long, these elements. Wouldn't the bottom element have to be made somewhat shorter to actually have that antenna resonant? I would imagine it would. So let me give you that much, and then we'll press on. Over.
Okay. The length of the coax cable is part of the phasing harness, which is part of that matchbox, that one port thing with a switching matrix and whatever. The bottom line is that when you build a phased array, what counts is the phase angle and amplitude of the signal that arrives at each one of the elements. How it gets there usually doesn't matter. That's part of the phase matching, impedance matching, and whatever. But the amplitude of the signal and the phase angle of the signal that arrives at each element, that's what creates the electronic steering. That signal, in general, doesn't care if it went through a long or a small or short piece of coax cable. If you're at a fixed frequency, when you start switching frequency, life gets a little bit more complicated. Now, when it comes to figuring out lengths of elements, whether or not they should be resonant, where the phase centers are, and whatever, I'm going to need a little bit more of a description. You call them four arrows that go out into four directions of space from the center tall tower. I'm having trouble picturing that. Those words are not enough. Either give me a website I can go to which shows an illustration, or tell me first what it would look like bird's eye view, top view, and then show me what it would look like plan view if I'm standing on the ground and looking straight at it. Describe one single element first, and then if the elements are a step and repeat, tell me what you changed to go from element number one to element number two. So right now, you haven't given me enough words for me to picture the element, nor for me to perceive. N2MB, KQIW on the TechNet.
Okay, let me try to explain the elements, because I'm having trouble finding the website. I've been doing that while I'm talking to you, but for some reason I can't find it. But we'll, it's, It's a company called Comtech Systems makes that phasing box. And I think somewhere in his literature he'll give you a picture of some guy that did this, but I'll get to that in a minute because I'm really having trouble finding that. I don't know why I'm having so much trouble finding it. But anyway, if you will picture a, you know what inverted V looks like, right? That, we'll start with that. You have a, you got a pole in the middle and you got the wire coming off, at, you know, like about 45 degrees. It's not, you know, veered forward. It's just a V straight up and down. You got that so far, right?
I sure do. That inverted V would look like an upside V in plan view. In bird's eye view, it would all collapse and look like one simple dipole, one straight out dipole.
Yeah, right. If you were looking straight down at it, you wouldn't see the V, right? Okay, that makes sense. Now take the inverted V and turn it vertical. Instead of having it horizontal, turn the whole thing vertical so that the feed point is like 60 feet off the ground, whatever, and this thing is V back towards your tower. Instead of being V towards the ground, it's being V back towards your tower. The same 45 degrees or whatever the V is angle on that. You picture that? That would place it about, that would place the feed point probably somewhere around 45 feet out from the tower, right?
Yes, and the altitude of the feed point would be roughly half the height of the tower. The lower half of the V would come close to the ground. The upper half of the V would come close to the top of the tower. I can picture that. Go ahead.
Okay, good, good. Now, you're going to make four of these around the tower. Obviously, they are, you know, what is it, 90 degrees, you know, 90 degrees, all the way around the tower. You're going to have four of these things, right?
Yes, I can see where you're going. And this fulfills the requirement that each phase center is displaced in three-dimensional space. The apex of each one of those Vs, where you bring the coax cable into it, is close to the phase center of that antenna. It's a little bit away from it, but it's close. So if that feed point is 45 feet out from the tower, and if I'm now considering the one that aims to the north and the one that aims to the south, and each one is 45 feet out from the tower, those two phase centers are close to 90 feet apart. Therefore, you can definitely make a vertically polarized phased array out of that. And you're about to worry about the fact that the lower half of the V of the dipole is coming closer to the ground. The upper half is not coming close to the ground. You're afraid that the two halves will have a different resonant frequency. Even if that occurs, that's a fancy way of saying you're not feeding it in the center. You don't have to feed a dipole in the center. If you've got the right kind of a balancing device, you can feed a dipole quite far off of center and still get very similar performance. So that thing that you're worried about is not a showstopper. Back to you, Barry.
Okay, yeah, that's what I thought. So I was thinking to bring it back to center because of ground effect, what I should probably do is shorten the bottom element by a few feet. Now, I could actually do this by just making a test jig. I would put the antenna up. I would have, say, 50-ohm coax going to the center instead of 75. And I would simply shorten the bottom element until this thing had a low SWR. This would bring me as close as I could to the center, I would assume.
Not required. You're worried that the lower half and the upper half are going to have a different resonant frequency. You'd be amazed how little difference there is in that effect. As long as you have the right kind of a balancing device at the feed point, all of that is a wash. Automatically gets corrected as long as it is a so-called current balance, not a voltage balance, a current balance, the W2DU type, the Unitella type, the one that when you chop it apart inside the PVC pipe, you got a whole bunch of toroid rings of ferrite. That kind of a balance used in the center of every of those dipoles doesn't care